When you wake up, will you be in the same dimension? When you wake up, will you be in the same body?
If you, like so many other people living on planet Earth, are experiencing mild or extreme dimensional slides when you fall asleep and you want to head back to the node of the multiverse that you used to exist in, then the folks over at DMC want you to know that they have the finest in dimensional mapping technology, allowing you to ensure that when you wake up, you will wake up in the same node of the multiverse that you fell asleep in, and if not, you'll be able to find a way back. Right now, if you use offer code, you will receive 30% off a bronzed Abyssinian temporal hyboreal projector, which will ensure that your dimensional sliding will be reduced to almost zero nano slicks. Again, that's offer code.
When you wake up, will you be in the same dimension? When you wake up, will you be in the same body?
Greetings, friends. It is I, D. Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Fan Podcast. I'm having some kind of
announcement from German Industries.
Right now with
prepare to receive sounding from chromatic recon.
Tonight! And so I'm working on it right now. I'm just going to cut to Samuel Taylor Coleridge.
Adamsel with Adulzheimer. In a vision once I saw, it was an Apusinian maid, and on her Dulzheimer SHE played, singing of Mount Abora. Could I revive within me her symphony and song, to such a deep delight to it win me, that with music loud and long, I would build that dome in air, that sunny dome. Those caves of ice, and all who heard should see them there, and all should cry, beware, beware, his flashing eyes, his floating hair, weave a circle round him, Trize, and close your eyes with holy dread, for he on honey death hath fed, and drank the milk of paradise.
Gary, what is that? I'm getting that weird
announcement
interference thing.
From Wellen Industries. Prepare to receive downlink
Gary,
from Chromatic Ribbon.
Stop there. Great. Sorry about that, gang. We're all experiencing, you know, varieties of temporal distortions and the Murphs and the Nevivasivers. And it's definitely happening with my technology. I think that filter I just put on has stopped the interruptions, which is great, so that I could continue the introduction of my podcast. For those of you who are new listeners, welcome. My name is Duncan Trussell, and you're listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast. God damn it. Gary. There it is again.
Announcement from Wellen Industries.
Just cut to commercial and then
prepare,
let's figure this out.
Receive.
When you're on a planet, you don't know what might happen. This kind of anxiety can keep you from fapping or making love to somebody who you want to. This is why we need Blue Chew.
As a 46-year-old man in a global pandemic with one testicle, I am not ashamed to say that I love Blue Chew. I love the effect that it has. It's got the same active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis. And right now isn't exactly what you would call the best time to head over to a pharmacy to pick up a prescription for anything. Blue Chew has got you covered. It's prescribed online by licensed physicians, so you don't have to go to the doctor's office, you don't have to wait in line at the pharmacy, and it ships right to your door in a discreet package. To be quite honest with you, I don't care if it's a discreet package. I don't care if my neighbors think, wow, Duncan needs help, making love in this bizarre paranoid fantasy where my neighbor is judging me based on my mail. I would say to him, you know, in the way an orange tree makes oranges, science gives us tools to improve our lives. And that's what Blue Chew is. So right now, if you go to bluechew.com, that's BLUE chew.com, and use promo code Duncan, you can try it for free. That's bluechew.com. You'll get your first shipment free when you use our special promo code Duncan. All you got to do is pay $5 for shipping. Again, that's BLUE chew.com, promo code Duncan, to try it for free. Blue Chew is the better, cheaper, faster choice, and I thank them for sponsoring the DTFH. Okay, enough of this cowardly escape into surrealism and absurdity. Friends, here's what's been going on with me. I have been promoting The Midnight Gospel, which comes out on Netflix on April 20th. It's been one of the most surreal, poignant weeks of my life. I'm sending them out during a global pandemic has been, to put it mildly, a little scary. Alright, well, I don't know how to stop this. I don't know what to do about it. So maybe we should just start the podcast.
From Wellen Industries.
Yeah, we'll just start the podcast. Please watch The Midnight Gospel coming to Netflix Dan, it's so nice to see you.
And thank you.
But this this way that I'm seeing you is, the more that I do this, it becomes increasingly sad.
Yeah. I keep thinking about, you know how like what became called the living room used to be called the parlor, and it was... and then they invented funeral parlors, and then they changed the name of the parlor to the living room because the funeral industry wanted to, I guess, supposedly, you know, they wanted to discourage people from having their dead relatives in their house for memorial services and stuff, because they wanted, so culturally there was this shift that we don't even know or care about, which is that all of a sudden this thing called the living room became a totally normal part of even the tiniest apartment. And I keep thinking during this pandemic about like what it's this is a big enough cultural shift that there could be a permanent thing added to like homes that's like has to do with like a little video station.
Oh. God,
like everyone will have a little corner with a green screen or just a good lighting, and you know it'll be like the equivalent of like a vanity for a woman's bedroom, or it's like every home will come up kind of equipped with a little video station. Because if not after this time, then definitely after the next pandemic. And what are we learning this time around? Except we can do this, like. And I was curious to talk to you because you and your family have a lot more roots in like the conspiracy world, and I haven't had the heart or the savvy to learn about any pandemic conspiracy theories yet.
Okay, well, I'll get to the conspiracy thing, but just what just happened to me during what you just said was deja vu. But it wasn't deja vu like normal deja vu. It was deja vu in the sense that I knew we were going to have this conversation. I've been looking forward to it. But I've also had this uneasy feeling because I knew that you were going to present an angle that I hadn't thought of. It was going to be really, really, really horrible. But I didn't know what it would be. I'm like, I'm going to talk to Harmon, and I know he's going to have a take on this that's going to like pull the rug out from under me. And you just did that. So now I have to like for a moment sit with this horrific dystopian future where instead of zombies, it's invisible, tiny death things in weird mists outside of our homes. And where within people are like, instead of huddling in front of the fireplace, they're going to their communication corner to talk to people they will never see in person again because the planet becomes increasingly virulent to the point that going outside becomes impossible. And now I just want to throw up.
Well, we'll just have like zones or something like, it'll be sort of like everyone will belong to a gated community in the sense that like, or there'll be like different colored wristbands for immunities.
Yeah.
And so then maybe bars will, you know, when you go to a bar, maybe it's like a yellow bar and that means everyone with a yellow bracelet, which is like latched on in this like hack proof way, which means you've been immunized. You have antibodies against like the yellow section of diseases. And then everyone just goes to these yellow bars and they just fuck, like, it's just like Roman. Like people are just fucking right there in the bar.
Well,
because talking to people closer to 6 feet will become lumped in with like sex.
Right.
So you may as well fuck as talk to your mailman.
That's it. You're fucking your mailman right now. I'm so glad that you have underlined the sexual element to this pandemic, which is that if you go outside right now with no mask on, that is barebacking. You are barebacking reality. And when you run, I went to my car. I had to get something out of my car. Which is surreal. I don't know. When was the last time you went to your car?
I don't know. It's sitting 20 feet from here, but every day I look at it and humble brag, I have a Tesla and it's got the charging cable plugged into it now for a month and a half or something. And I keep going like, I should unplug that car.
Gotta unplug it.
Because maybe the battery will swell or something. And then I always think I'm going to unplug it and then I'm going to forget I unplugged it. And then the fucking renegades from Sector 7 are going to start raiding Valley Village and I'm going to run to the car with Cody and there's going to be 10 miles on the battery.
Yeah, but number one, I have just moved to the Valley. Number two, when some white flash of light explodes into the sky, I'll be like, that's Harmon's Tesla. He should have unplugged it. Fuck, it exploded. It's just been gathering energy. You got to unplug that Tesla, man. Please, for all of us in the Valley, please unplug it. But yeah, you know, a jogger jogged by my car when I went to my car. And I wasn't wearing a face mask. He wasn't wearing a face mask. I don't know who he was. But in that moment, I thought, wow, one of us could have just killed the other in this moment and not even ever know it. And it was the most surreal and fucked up experience. You know, that to me, this situation is filled with so many of those moments that I used to think of as my favorite moments, which is what you thought the thing would look like turns out to be the not at all what it would look like. You know what I mean? Usually this is in relation to like, you know, the first time you come, you know, do you remember your first orgasm? You hear about that there's the possibility. Have you ever come? I'm sorry, Dan.
I'm still looking forward to it.
It's not a myth. But, you know, like your first orgasm, you hear about it. You hear about it. You hear there's a thing that can happen. You get some sense that there's this thing. And then your first orgasm, it's like, that is not what I thought it would be. Wow, it's better than I thought it would be. Or maybe if you have what's called a theophany, you know, or some kind of psychedelic connection with the divine, it's like, that is nothing like what I thought that was going to be like. It's, how could I have? This is a similar thing, but in the negative, in the sense that this apocalypse, who the fuck could have predicted this one? You know, this is nobody, like in my assessment of apocalypse, the genre itself, where is this in there? You know, it's
because it's such a baby step.
Yeah.
The thing that's, I mean, is if this was it, I would be like, this is great as far as apocalypses go, chiefly because, well, we're going to live through this. And I will say I'm immunocompromised. So unless anybody listening thinks that I'm being insensitive, like I truly do have reason as per my doctor to like, I'm kind of like one of the people you're washing your hands for. Wow. And it is a game of hot lava for me, but I kind of, when it comes to the one for one, like this is your apocalypse negotiation, I'm like, thank you, God. This is actually really cool. Like in all of the different ways that Dan Harmon could have found out at 47 years old that he might be about to die, this is the easiest, like laziest, like I've been being given the most amount of control. Like I can make decisions if I really want to, like stay in my closet with a bucket over my head and an oxygen tube coming in. And it's, and so if I do get it from an Amazon box, I get to know that I did have options. I could have put a bag over my head. And then also on top of that, if I do get it, and even if I do die, probably 2 weeks or at least a couple days to say goodbye, to put my house in order, to sign my will, to like, if all of that was just it, I'd be like, this is the best. Like, this is the best we ever could have hoped for. The problem is, what I've always anticipated being the actual apocalypse, like where you and I aren't able to have a podcast and make jokes and have anxieties about things because shit just goes from zero to fight or flight as a way of life, is I always figure the odds are it's going to be an economic collapse that brings that on. It's going to be good old fashioned poor people being hungry and having crowbars that, and not trusting each other and all of the telecommunications going out. So nobody has any recourse to shame or social mores. And everyone's just kind of hungry and hearing rumors that the people down the street have already begun looting or cannibalizing. And so you're a dummy if you don't. And shit can go so bad so quickly if all that happens is the dollar goes from being worth $1 to being worth 2 cents. I mean, so let alone if the police aren't going to show up if you call them. I mean, everything is based on money. And this, every time they talk about how this is economically, you know, irreversible, that's my panic. I kind of worship a God that would make this happen if I said it out loud, but I think I would rather burn alive in an inferno that just burnt us all to a crisp than die by home invasion while being unable to protect my dogs and Cody.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Right. Like what was that terrible murderer that, Patton Oswalt's late wife was studying, the
Golden State killer.
That motherfucker. Yeah, that's all of our nightmares, is that.
Jesus.
And, Yeah.
I mean, those people exist right now. They existed in non-pandemic times. That's what freaks me out. It's like, how many sociopaths have you met the last couple of years? Like, some of them are your friends and you're like, yeah, that guy's kind of a psychopath though. Like, he's held in line by, like, it's more profitable to, you know, not let people know that he has no empathy and like, yeah, has fucking like actually maybe a sadistic streak to him. Yeah. And like, it's about 1 out of 100 people that we know. And then there's everybody that we don't know. And then it's like, oh boy, you know, we are held by a like dental floss thick like thread to, you know, just what we think of as rule of law.
Yeah. You know, there was a celebration of sociopathy. I don't know if you know, remember when that was started generating, like, well, you know, certain sociopaths, they do have, like, the question is, why do we have sociopaths? And from an evolution, bioevolutionary perspective, well, because if you're living in some situation where everyone's hyper compassionate and empathetic, that's not going to be a trait that gives you long-term survivability.
Right.
Because you need someone who is able to kill the cute animals that you eat. Like, there's just that. You got to have somebody who can shoot down something with a face so we can boil its flesh and eat it.
Yeah.
And then you see how selection would, you know, gradually that could move past just the animals to people. And then eventually you have like human robots among us. And then you realize that in a situation like this, yeah, just what you're saying, this like invisible thread of just agreement, essentially, the same thing that makes the dollar work is the same thing that keeps people from invading your house. It's like, you know, there's an imaginative process that goes into the creation of the illusion of safety. And for me, this is why the other day I'm like washing my dishes and looking out the window. And it's like the best. I feel like a Zen master washing my dishes, not because I'm a Zen master, but because I'm literally thinking like, I don't know, man. Tomorrow I might start coughing. The next day I might kind of, you know, come to and I'm like, where, what's going on? And then try to pull the thing out of my mouth. And then that's it, you know, because that's how you die. You know, it's a slow disintegration. I don't mean to shit all over your fantasy or your 2 week thing or whatever.
Well,
but it could just be you wash your dishes, then you're like, "What the fuck's in my? I can get this out of my. Why are you killing?" And then you die. Yeah. So you know what I mean. So that makes the dishwashing experience particularly like romantic. You know, the home invasion. We disagree in this sense. It's just like, I mean, I don't want anyone in my family to ever get hurt, but Jesus Christ, man, that flickering in and out of consciousness as you have some vague sense that you're, something's not just quite right, and then blink out of existence forever. Ooh. That one eats me alive,
man. Well, that's an interesting point, because that's another, on the positive side, that's one of many good things about this shared experience we're all having. One of them is, well, what about the 99% of us that are learning in a very concrete way that we don't need police and that we don't need money and that we, you know, there's a very cynical way of looking at that, which is to say everyone's a sheep except for sociopaths. And oh my God, this whole Jenga tower could come down because it's only held together by people's assumptions and naivete. But there's also a positive way of looking at that, which is like, well, that's not naivete, that's compassion. It's an altruistic, polite agreement that most people, a vast majority of human beings, come out of the womb able to snap into. And you know, you walk your dog around the block and every neighbor you see, you know, there's a shared experience. And it's not so much the niceties, which are engaged in, like, oh, how are you guys doing? If you need any help, we have an extra turkey or whatever the fuck. I don't quite mean that. It's just sort of like just the connection that you now have with a bunch of people, and you kind of get the sense that when the shit hits the fan, there is an overwhelming tendency for humankind to kind of school like fish, but in a healthy way, that they wouldn't turn each other away, that they would help each other out, that we have an almost like panic response. But I digress there. But the other positive thing about it is the positive way of looking at what I said, which is like, oh, supposedly we're all experiencing how close we are to death, maybe, but we're not, as you point out. This is actually a great way to realize that, like, God, this is like the furthest from death you usually are. It's just that you're kind of statistically very unlikely to have a catastrophic stroke while you're washing your dishes. But my friend Mike Mendell, who's healthier than me, and, you know, he went to a Dodgers game with the Rick and Morty staff, and he went home and he apparently just collapsed. He just went out like a light, which is what you're describing, which is so much scarier than having a dry cough and a fever and going, this is it. And yet, technically speaking, we are all so much closer to that fate, no matter how statistically unlikely it is. Statistics aren't a comfort. The truth is your brain is a big bowl of pudding held together with like weird, like fluid dynamics. Like why not have one part of it just and like you fall over like a sack of flour. The idea that there's a molecule living up the street, not living even, they're not even alive, these fucking things that are smaller than the breadth of a human hair by orders of magnitude, that it's not even alive and it's sitting there and it's waiting for me. And if it could get into my lung tissue, it wouldn't even have an orgasm. It wouldn't even be like, I finally got Dan Harmon. It doesn't know who I am. It doesn't even give a fuck. It's not batting for any team. It's just like, it's just part of this emergent molecular behavior, and it's out there and it's like hunting for me. That is like, that is such a far away death. It's such a manageable death compared to the death that we have been engaging in the game of Russian roulette that is life.
Yeah, you know, remember like when that guy climbed up that tower and just started shooting people? He knew
you'll have to be more specific.
Oh, God. What the fuck, man?
The guy in Texas, the original.
Oh, my God, the original. Oh, Dan, what? God, Dan, I knew you were going to be, wow. Yeah.
Well, I don't know how many tower shooters there have been.
Jesus Christ. The original, back in the old days, the vintage tower shooter. He like knew he had a brain to, he left a note saying, look,
at my eyes.
Something's wrong with me. But that situation of suddenly like there's a sniper taking people out, and we look at that, you know, and all the depictions and reenactments of it, and it's like, oh God, what a nightmare. And the reason it's people have such an intense reaction to it, and it's because that is the situation, which is that there is some sniper who is launching phenomena out of the rifle of time into our particular lives. And at any given moment, that thing could just decide it's time to like take you out of the simulation. And this is a very uncomfortable predicament to be in. And to combat it, we weave together all these safety illusions. One of the primary ones being, do you remember when that song came out about 911 being a scam? Remember that song? Yeah. Like, but we all had this idea you could call 911 and like in seconds, police are going to be at your house saving you, when the reality is, well, it depends on what neighborhood you're in. And even if you are in a nice neighborhood, it just depends on what's going on, man. There's only a certain number of cops. And it depends on how close they are. You know how it is with Uber. You know, it's the same with cops. It's like maybe there's a fire, or maybe the cops are like the cops using the bathroom. And then there's another cop over there who's like technology got weird for a second. Or maybe the GPS coordinates got weird on their way to the house. And during that time, you're being strangled by somebody and you just barely managed to call 911. But there's an illusion in your mind that, oh, no. There's this button I can press where the state will inject itself into my life and protect me. And it produces this sort of beautiful numbness, right, that we all build our lives inside of so that we get to procrastinate. That's the game, isn't it? It's like I don't need to really tell my wife how much I love her and how much she means to me, and that if she were to die, then I wouldn't want to be alive, and that I'm so grateful for her strength and I'm amazed at the way she is with the baby, and I wish I were even 1/90th as strong as her. I'm clearly not. I don't need to say that now because, you know, there's 2 weeks.
Right.
And that which is the – so somehow I guess it the connection between the reality of there being the sniper and our lives – when that really solidifies, what is that? Is that enlightenment? Is that what enlightenment is? Is not just some glorious, sanctimonious, epiphanous, eternal halo. It's just you realize for real, oh shit, yeah, I don't think I have 10 seconds left to live. And then you just start acting like that in every moment.
I guess. I mean, but I always think like the metaphor I come back to is if I'm hammering a nail into wood, there's this sort of like inevitable event that's going to happen where I'm going to hit my thumb with the hammer. And the reason I'm going to hit my thumb with the hammer is because I'm going to increase the rate at which I'm pounding, and I'm going to get more and more confident, and I'm going to swing harder in the course of getting the job done. And I don't want to say it's impossible to drive a nail into wood by making the carefulest 0% chance of hitting your own thumb kind of strokes. Maybe there is a way to like tap, 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 tap a nail all the way into a 2x4. I don't actually think there is. I think sooner or later, if you want to get the thing done, if you want to live your life, for example, you need to get into a rhythm. You need to take your girlfriend's life for granted. You need to wake up in the morning and actually have a baseline of, yeah, this is the new happy. Now it's called normal. Now happy has to trump that. And that's human nature. And we have accomplished a great deal. We invented pudding and lasers. I mean, things that a caveman would be like, are you out of your fucking mind? You're trying to come up with a way to make chocolate into a gel? do you not see the saber-toothed tiger like sniffing around the camp? I need more wood. But step by step, we do this beautiful thing where we build, we go out on a limb. I think it's part of what we're supposed to do. We are living in a fantasy world, and you and I are just lamenting right now and kind of kvetching about how that fantasy world is so far out on such a limb that, oh, look at the funny situation that happens. Look how much bowing in the wind this 2x4 has, like where we're hanging above New York, and we're just like, what were we thinking? Why did we make this building so tall? Oh my God.
Yeah.
But it's not really – it would be one thing if every time that happened, humankind learned that their venturing was folly and counterproductive. But in fact, what humankind has learned is the opposite, because the one time that for centuries we both had culture and almost went extinct, basically, was the Dark Ages. It was that period of time – where the church got its way, that they're always trying to get, and they were like, no, we're in charge now. I want to have no more of this bullshit. It's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, and whatever the medieval equivalent of that shit was. And it was just like, that was called the Dark Ages. And And it just didn't work. And the leitmotif was, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And don't aspire to anything. And always be grateful. Always be humble. Like that is, as far as our species goes, historically, that's actually how we fuck ourselves. And when we are, yeah, we're like, we act like fucking, like lazy, weird, like, how could you not have any self-awareness and perspective? How did you become this weird fucking like cuckoo bird that only understands the world through their PlayStation and blah, blah, blah. And how could you not see this Pompeii coming? But there's always like, that's just 85% of the people. I mean, and that's not even like, oh, that's the fat. And then there's the meat of the Einsteins. It's like the Einsteins come from that fat. Right. Like they, you can't tell the difference between them. Like it is what we are. We're like this like species whose emergent behavior that made us better suited for survival than chimpanzees was that we're terrible gamblers. We're like right. compulsive. Yeah. We're constantly like betting our birthday on the roulette table with every bit of our life savings. Like we're just always yeah. like, well, I got a good feeling. I warm this table up, but we kind of like keep winning.
This thing that you're talking about now, this is where like if it's like put the baby to bed and then we've had enough wine and I'll feel myself being like drunk, I'll think what a fucking luxury this is to be drunk, you know, like because there could come a time, and there certainly was a time, where eye hand coordination meant you survived. And that if you were in a space where there was even the luxury of getting so high that you didn't have those things, you must be doing great. Like, congratulations. Wow. You're in some kind of, you know, societal blister within which you get to like float around all drunk and fucked up. Because the way it appears to be is that is not necessarily a trait that is going to increase your survivability. But that being said, and all the death shit aside, to me, one of the peculiarly disturbing qualities of the experience is the reminder that things as they are do not continue, that expectations do not, on the global level, our expectations of what this summer was going to be like have not been met. I was going to be a Burning Man. I was going to go to Burning Man this summer. And that sounds trite and stupid or whatever, but I was really looking forward to it, man. That's not happening. All the things we had, all our plans, everything we thought we were going to do as a planet, those are now out the window. Now, that being said, another thing we all share on a planetary level is this conceptualization of death itself. And to me, one of the more disturbing things about this is if we take this far enough, the dreamy quality of the experience that we're having, there's something in it that almost is sneakily saying, are you really sure you're going to die? Are you really sure that's even going to happen? You think that the time stream continuum and history and society and all of the things that you consider to be what is keep going? You think the metric of the quantification methods of science, empiricism, you think that's going to keep going? Do you think that's going to stay the same way? Because look, this didn't stay the same way. And I know you can't say because this didn't stay the same way, therefore the entirety of all physics falls apart. But that's what's interesting when they talk about black holes. They say, we don't know what's going on in that motherfucker. Because inside the black hole, physics falls apart. We can't get in there to look at the data set. Black holes are a representation on the massive scale of the fact that sometimes it just doesn't work out for physics itself.
Well, and certainly like when we're talking about viruses, which is, it's just a strand of self-replicating RNA. It doesn't even meet our definitions of life in a world where moss does and amoeba do. Like it, and yet it's kind of, I mean, I'm straying outside my wheelhouse, but I'm pretty sure that's how we began. That's how, I mean, life started as something that wasn't quite alive, but was self-replicating. And so to your point, it's like, even though a worse friend of yours than I am might say to you, well, that's silly, just because there's an epidemic doesn't mean that gravity might stop working tomorrow, or we might find out gravity never existed. But I'm your very good friend who is able to yes and you and go, yeah, no, because there is a fundamental unknown about virology. Like, the even though we're 60 years into people spending their entire lives looking at these things under microscopes and studying them and understanding them, obviously no one understands viruses enough that this didn't happen.
Right.
Like, no one understands them so well that trillions and trillions of dollars aren't currently hanging on the whim of a fucking virus.
Right.
Believe me, we've had a lot of incentive to be able to predict and control what we thought we understood in a textbook sense, which is how a virus works. And there is a pinhole there in that shows that we always just don't quite get it all.
Yeah.
And so you may as well contemplate a version of tomorrow where you wake up and your bed is in the middle of a white void, and Captain Crunch is standing there at the foot of it and going, like, you didn't know you were a cereal promotion? Like, and you wouldn't really have a right to be incredulous given all the parts of regular non-Captain Crunch simulation life that you experienced that kept telling you over and over again, there are so many things in the universe, so many more things that are dreamt of in your philosophy.
Would play it cool, Dan. I would play it cool. That's what I would do.
That is the way to do it. Yeah, you should at least, like, you don't have to, like, wake up every morning and roll over and kind of almost ruin your girlfriend's day by giving her a big lecture about how grateful you are and how it's so great that you both can walk and then go wash dishes. You can continue to take that for granted and get into the rhythm that'll drive the nail into the wood, as long as you are always in a state of mind where you're like, but don't forget, when shit takes a left turn,
yeah.
If I go from washing dishes to Captain Crunch, like, greeting me at the foot of my bed, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go, what? And blow his mind. I'm going to be like, yeah.
What you just did is, this is a perfect description of karma and reincarnation. And that is the idea. The idea is, at some point, you're going to wake up and Captain Crunch is going to be sitting at the foot of your bed. You're going to be in a Captain Crunch promo. You're not going to have much of a memory of this at all. There might be some dim recollection. You'll more than likely remember, God damn it, I got to cut down on the anhexedrine I've been snorting in the bathroom when I'm doing my commercial promos for Captain Crunch, because it's giving me all these past life hallucination memory things. But I got to do this commercial. And then you're going to do your commercial. And then you're going to forget this life altogether. And that's the idea of reincarnation. There isn't, like, this death and then you go to the eternal infinite spa where you hang out in the hot tub and you talk to Jesus and you say, you know, next life, I want to be a Dan Harmon. I'm going to make some awesome comedy shows. I'm going to learn a lot about what it means to be an artist, and I'm going to suffer, and I'm going to have these basic conditions. I'm going to have I want to be immunocompromised, so throw me in a pandemic. None of that shit. It's just, ba-bam, there you are, Captain Crunch commercial. You rationalize why you're there, and you keep dreaming forever. This, to me, is, on one level, if you're someone who's terrified of death, might sound like a relief. On another level, it's one of the more terrifying qualities of existing as a sentient being. Because, damn it, man, we can all count on death. We can all count on the abyss. We can all count on oblivion. We can all count on the extermination of our nervous system and some beautiful sedation that goes on for infinity, right? That's what Dawkins says. But what if we don't even get that? Fuck. That's terrifying.
But who are you if you're, if one minute you're Napoleon and then you're Duncan Trussell when Napoleon dies? And I mean, who, why is that terrifying if it's not even, and why is that you?
Well, that's the thing. There's just a trace residue. It's the point, you know, like right before you say something, you've got that momentum behind the whatever the thing that's going to come out of your mouth is. You're not sitting there like putting letters together or like trying to, you know, like when you're like in VR trying to type into a keyboard to make words form. There's just this instantaneous expulsion of words that comes out of your mouth. And if you have to exert too much energy doing that, well, that's when you're eating shit when you're on stage as a comic. That's when you know it's time when you're writing to stop for a second or get more high or less high. That's when it's time to take a nap, when there's that weird like period in between what's inside of you coming out of you. So that's the karmic atomic sort of quality of beingness, the individuality, if there is any, this kind of like weird wave that is producing a repetitive form of behavior that you identify as like, that's what I'm like, but you've got a Dan Harmon body around it and all in your house and your the sum total of the stuff that you've created. You know what I mean? But that's the thing. That's the shell that you keep building into time, so to speak. I knew.
So the kind of, like the scary thing about it to you is the idea, kind of like is the thing that I'm saying is the not scary thing about it, which is the lack of identity. It's the fact that you might be part of a co-op, that that it's not your consciousness that defines who you are. It's this string of like cosmically unremarkable, like throbbing meta tissue that has a sort of fundamental awareness of how it's been twitching and pulsing through all these lifetimes. And that the idea that you might have been Napoleon and are now you and might then be Jeff Foxworthy after you have a stroke tomorrow. Like the thing that's upsetting about that to you is that there is a Duncan Trussell through all of those things, but it's like this base wriggling, spasming, pathetic kind of like,
how dare you? I will take bass and I will take wriggling and maybe spasmodic, but pathetic, Dan, please. No, I know. It's to me, the terror is irrelevant. I mean, that's the other aspect of the apocalypse. It doesn't give a fuck. You want to be afraid? Great. You want to bow down to it? Great. You want to take babies on top of a pyramid and like, you know, cut their hearts out and present it to the apocalypse? No one gives a fuck. That's the book of Job. It's like, who are you? You tiny little fleck of a thing. You know, it doesn't matter. And to me, if you want that to be terrifying, great. If you want it to be a sink into absurdism, go ahead. If you want to try to find some Buddhist middle way, good luck. Enjoy your time. It doesn't matter. What we're talking about is that we have somehow, you and I, become sentient. And we, when I say become, it implies that you were non-sentient and then decided, I want to start thinking. You didn't even do that. Just suddenly, bloop, you're a Harmon and now you're here. And I'm a Duncan and now I'm here. And this entire life that we had, this series of events, each cycle of a year, has at this moment, at least temporarily, completely changed. And that is a reminder, I guess, that it just don't go like we think it's gonna go. And I don't know, to me that sometimes is terrifying, sometimes exciting, sometimes boring, sometimes obvious. I knew this would happen, by the way. I just figured if I start doing this podcast with you, someone would mow my grass outside.
Wait, oh, is that you? Is that on your side or that was mine?
You didn't know if that was on your side or not?
Yeah.
I shouldn't have said anything. I could have blamed it on you.
You don't have 7-day-a-week gardeners? I do.
Look, forget the whole terrifying thing. I want to know this. How's your relationship right now? If that's not too intimate a question, how are you dealing with being in a relationship and being in quarantine simultaneously?
It's going objectively, by my subjective definition of objectively, like, I think it's going objectively well. I think that from a bird's eye view, like, Cody and I are two writers. We're also like homebodies. Like, we really were not like thriving on extroversion as a couple or as individuals. We if anything, we were sort of a thread of our relationship is that we shared a sort of shame that we relieved each other of about how much we like just staying in bed and watching Netflix and playing video games and cuddling and whatever. And the pandemic then takes the shame part away because we're not even supposed to be wanting to go out.
Right.
So in the general sense, we're nailing it and we're having a great like honeymoon kind of thing. And we're also like, because there's no housekeepers and things, there's like, we're having an awakening to the joy of sweeping and mopping and doing laundry and cooking.
Yeah.
On a micro level, there's just the fucking fact that there's cabin fever that I didn't know I was getting it. I think that's part of the problem of it is like, well, everything objectively is going our way. So I have no right to be annoyed. I have no right to be frustrated. I have no right to be claustrophobic. And then, you know, we've had a couple of little rows, me and Cody, about like that. It's the age old, if you're 25 years old, this is your life. Someone has to take out the garbage. Someone's doing dishes. Like, and everyone has a different philosophy about who's keeping track of when they do it.
Yes.
And so that is happening to us. Like, we're not 25. Like we don't have, it's like, we just don't have our housekeeper coming over anymore. So there's been a couple of like, you know, don't you dare. I mean, there was a woman in my house when I was 10 years old, whose name I will protect. It rhymes with mom. my experience with someone in my house that lives with me doing laundry would be that then, oh, great, my clothes is clean, but I never asked for anyone else to do this, and now someone might remind me later, well, I did all the laundry, ... and yeah. The implication is that you're not pulling your weight around here. And I'm a very shame-driven guy, so
me too.
Truthfully, I've been the cause of any of the spat. I'm coming to the plate loaded with shame. So Cody might be saying something like, she honestly might just be like, at face value, being like, well, I made breakfast and then I fed the dogs and then I did this and did that. And like, she might just really mean, hey, you didn't notice that, not you're taking advantage of me and you should do more. But I will interpret it that way, for instance. And then, you know,
I just had that fight last night with my wife in reverse. That fight where, like, you know, she's taking care of our baby while I work and podcast and do the promos for the show. And like, she's like, you know, kicking ass. I can't believe it. It's just amazing. And so she last night said to me, you know, she said like something like, I'm tired after the baby goes down. I don't know about cooking. And I'm in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, we've got this like lamb. And I'm like, oh, there's lamb we should cook. She took that as me saying, you better cook that lamb. It's the apocalypse. And, you know, and from that perspective, if that was what I was saying, it's horrific to imagine taking care of a baby all day long while your, like, stoner husband's job is, like, making a podcast and music or whatever. And then, like, it seems like he said, cook my lamb. I mean, don't you see my Moog fingers are tired from spinning my synthesizer dials? When really what I meant is I will cook the lamb. I like cooking. I enjoy it right now. But fuck, that to me is the, like, retreat nature of being stuck in a house with somebody, is you really do have to start checking your projections, you know, and you realize how powerful that ruins your life, those projections, because, you know, a lot of Cody just wants you to know she clean, because it feels good when someone you're with is like, good job. And yeah. You're taking that as her saying, you slob. Why don't you do anything? Yeah, that's the worst, man. That's like part of it. Not the worst, but yeah. And also the other thing is like, Jesus Christ. And I hate, you know, I don't mean to be all like woke or whatever, but this is a real teaching and privilege, isn't it? Right?
Oh, yeah.
We had a fucking nanny, man. We had people clean our house. And now we're having to do all the shit that, like, for a lot of people, that's just what it's like to live.
Yeah.
You know, that's day-to-day life.
Yeah, it is making me like, it's been 6 or 7 years since I noticed the floors that I walk on.
Yeah.
Because if they're always clean, then you don't pay attention to the floor in a video game that you're playing, because the amount of dirt will never change the gameplay. And that's the life of a rich person, is your floors are video game floors, because some other person has to think about dirt accruing on them and keep them free of an amount of dirt. But now it's like, there's 20% more dirt on this bathroom tile. And if someone doesn't mop it, it's going to continue to get dirtier and dirtier. Yeah. It sounds like the dumbest thing to characterize as a new experience for 98% of your listeners, but it is like a component that actually for me is going really well. Now, I mean, the to go back to me self-loathing a little bit, because something I thought was really funny is, like, remember how I was just saying, like, I hate it when people keep a tally of the chores they do, and then all of a sudden they remind you of how much they've done. And I was in my most recent and hopefully final, like, flare up with Cody, where chores came up. It was so ridiculous, and I'm so grateful that she didn't skewer me more on the hypocrisy of this. But like, I was like railing against her, I was railing against that phenomenon. I was like, I don't understand when people are like, I did the laundry and I kept track of all this. I don't want you to do the laundry. It's like, and then I ran down this list of shit that I do and put up with as if to demonstrate that I'm not like that. But I had a fucking list. Like, that was my proof. I was like, I'm not like that. I just live in the moment. So last Tuesday at 1:15, when you were bitching about the fucking ham bones in the freezer, I didn't do nothing because I'm fucking awesome.
I'm awesome. Don't you see that? Yes, Dan.
It was really humiliating. And she didn't even fucking... I don't want to generalize, but I do think that's like, women are superior to men in arguments, because even though our perception of them is that they, we tend to, it's like the autonomic responses are different. And so women, through the eyes of men in a couple fight, it tends to be like, the woman won't drop it. You know what I mean? And men are like more prepared to like shut down and like, women never get credit for the fact that they play the bigger game. Like, they don't actually spike a football that you hand them because they'd rather be happy. Like, they see no profit in fucking like going like, ah ha.
Yeah. So
like when a man like makes an ass of himself in at the end of a tete-a-tete, like the woman has a capability of saying like, okay, good. He just made a complete ass of himself. That means that maybe there's a resolution here.
Wow. Because
maybe he'll, like maybe he'll finally fucking like his tantrum will conclude and he'll realize that we're both in this together. Whereas the man is like, I don't know. I mean, I know I'm making these sweeping generalizations, but
no.
That is, I'm not pretending to believe that there aren't a billion different kinds of people and spectrums of
yeah, of course,
gender roles and things. I'm just making Jeff Foxworthian generalizations, but
Jeff Foxworthy's on your mind a lot. Right
I know,
now.
Yeah.
He's What's in my going on with that?
That's what McGathy used to call it, my iCloud. She's like, you have 6 references a week. And you just bend them to whatever conversation you're in.
Man, you know, that thing, thank God for that thing for sure. And anytime the bank teller in my mind or the accountant in my mind or the auditor in my mind decides to take over my body and remind the person I'm with of like how much they owe or how much I've invested into this thing or that, it's always an embarrassment and it's hard to stop. You know, your mom probably did that to you. You know, that's a generational thing. You know, it's how you keep the story going, you know?
Well, I think but now I'm realizing because of that humiliating experience where I was like, oh God, my mom did that, but it might be even more accurate to say everyone does it. And my bookmark in my head is that's a mom thing. And I do it too. But like I live in some weird twisted lie where when I'm doing it, it's not doing it. And like everyone else is my mom when they do it. But I'm my fucking mom if when you do it, you're your mom. And like because I clearly do it.
Right.
Like my therapist has been talking to me about trust, and I've been able to understand trust as like the foundation of a relationship. But now we're moving into like trust just in general of like trust between me and you in this conversation, trust between me and employees and employers when we're trying to tackle a creative issue. Lack of trust is a thing that I am engaging in when, for instance, I say to a writer, you know what, you did fine. Just give me the draft and I'll work on it this weekend. Like whether I'm thinking that person deserves a break from my tyranny or thinking that they're a hack that can't handle the work that needs to be done, they're both the same thing. It's just me having an inability to interface with another human being because I just don't have a trust that we'll be able to work it out together.
Right.
And
how do you get trust back? How do you do that? Is she teaching?
My therapist belongs to the school that is like, all you can do and all you have to do is put a road flare on these things and be aware of them. And then over time they will change because you'll slow down your cognitive time in those moments. Instead of them being habit and reflexive, you will, so if you quitting smoking is the easy example to use. If the problem is that you're smoking before you're even thinking about it, and it almost seems therefore to you like you can't do anything about it. The real problem is that you've achieved a bridge between behaviors. Like I'm sitting on the couch and now I'm smoking. Like you've eliminated every fucking nanosecond of possible thought about the process. And supposedly all you really have to do, you don't have to like use all these techniques of like, I'm going to chew a toothpick. I'm going to do all these things. Like the best way to do it is just to, you know, systematically increase your awareness of those moments. You don't take it upon yourself to quit smoking. Just start by going, I am a smoker. Okay. And every time you're having a cigarette, you just go, I am smoking a cigarette. And it's like, that's just, you just need to get those fingers pried into those elevator doors And then it will just naturally start to widen. Because think about the dilemmas that you have. If somebody says, I'm pregnant, or should we go to the Bee Gees reunion tonight? Like, you can stretch a fucking decision into hours and hours of contemplation, during which you could feel a million different ways about the Bee Gees. Because it's not a thing that you've woven into the root system of your tree. Whereas having a beer, having a cigarette, you're at risk of patterned behaviors that are just like, boom, this is a freeway. It's a pneumatic tube that just goes.
Oh, that's great. You know, this is what I love about that. The implication is that awareness is fundamentally good. That awareness is a fundamentally good, do you remember which Star Trek it was where they shot the Genesis seed on the planet and regrew it and you get like a baby Spock or whatever? Like, you know what I'm talking about?
I like you switch to the royal you for the last part and you get like a baby Spock as one does. I believe that would be you're referring technically to two Star
Trek.
Is that
two?
Well, the two, I think at the end of two, is Wrath of Khan.
Yes, it's Wrath of Khan, for
and
sure.
And at the end of it, Spock dies, I think.
Yes.
And then three is the search for Spock, I believe.
Okay, got it. Right. You get a baby. So, like, you launch the seed. It's the best way to kill off a character and bring the fucking character back. Brilliant. Also, Wrath of Khan. It's got those ear things. I still remember pulling them out of the aquarium. Those ear mites. It's the guy from Fantasy Island. What's that actor's name?
Ricardo Montalban.
Ah, the best. But regardless, the awareness is like that bomb, or the reverse of a bomb. You put awareness on anything, and suddenly that thing begins to improve, even though it might not seem as though it's improving. Over time plus awareness with any behavior, there seems to be a gradual decrease in the negative qualities of the behavior. And eventually, either you stop doing the thing or you get better at it. You know what I'm saying? Awareness,
yeah.
It's almost like proof of God's existence.
Yes, well, it's proof of chaos in a really like uplifting way. It's like, oh, there's an order to habitual thought, and but sometimes to our chagrin, like we look at this like it's a bad thing, but it's like Murphy's Law. It's like whenever anything's actually important, there's this weird increase in the odds that something's going to go wrong. Like every little aspect of your AV project, your microphone settings and all that stuff. It's like, you're paying attention to all of these things. It's not, you're not doing it by rote. And when every single decision and every single moment is being experienced in the moment, you're increasing the chances of randomness, which is also how you get creativity. It happens like as naturally as gravity. Something that people in our line of work know is all too hard to achieve sometimes, which is like lateral thought. So if you're walking from one city to another in medieval times, and there's only like foot travel and carts, and so there's like these worn paths that go between the major cities and things. And like, you can zone out and stare at your sandals and walk between the two cities, and you're going to naturally go along the path that you've traveled before and along the path that other people have traveled before. But if you were to stop on a hill halfway through your journey and get out your compass or even just stop and have lunch, the odds of you taking the exact same path you've always taken, they decrease dramatically. And it's not because you're a good, inventive, wonderful person who's brave. It's because you'll have time while you're chewing your sandwich. You'll just be like, actually, come to think of it, my friend lives in Silver Lake, not Los Angeles. So I think I'm just gonna you know, I'm going to go 20 degrees different. And that's almost a mischaracterization, because that implies that, oh, it's our responsibility to make these good decisions. It's just chaos theory. It's like when Jeff Goldblum is explaining a water drop going down Laura Dern's hand, if every time the water drop stops instead of just following a path, then every spot along that path, the direction becomes random from there. So if you wanted to quit smoking or quit abusing people or quit drinking or quit being defensive or learn to trust people, the first step to all of those processes is to like just like put a post-it note or a road flare or a piece of gum on those moments that will slowly accrue, like, oh, geez, this is the fifth time I've smoked a cigarette. And the first time I was really good about going, I'm smoking a cigarette. Then there came those three times I forgot to do that. Oh, fuck, I fucked up. But it's like, you thought about it a little bit. And then over time, now by the same process that got you to be a smoker, you're accruing this like ball of gum on the railroad track that leads from you to smoking, and then increasingly this like mechanism starts like every time you smoke a cigarette, you're like it becomes part of the path that like vroom, there's this speed bump there. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger because you're depositing more awareness on it, and then you're slowing down time, and eventually it's so slowed down that it happens gradually, but theoretically, you're about to smoke a cigarette and it's so slowed down that you're able to get distracted by a glass of lemonade or a nap or a fucking hot dog or just like, and like that is the supposed like path to changing any of your your neurology.
You keep describing Buddhism, man. That's the idea when you, so what you're describing, the in-between place is called the bardo, in-between place. And another word for it is the gap. People even talk about applying that awareness to the space in between out-breath and in-breath. That space in between those things is what you are. That space in between the decision to smoke and smoking, that's where we are. And the whole thing is being clouded by this infinite tapestry of these little decisions that we make, and awareness somehow zooms you in. It's a convenient way to close up the podcast, but is maybe that's what this pandemic is for the entire planet. It's forcing us into a gap, into a bardo, into this space in between the addictive habituations that were causing the ice caps to melt.
Yeah, well, think about the whole generation of high school kids that, like, I mean, remember when you were in high school and it was like your fucking life was about, I mean, literally life and death. I mean, ask any person that went to Columbine, like life and death were at stake about things like what pants you were going to wear on Monday, let alone if you were prepared for your final exams in biology class, your college entrance exams. All of society in total lockstep about how fucking important Monday morning was for your gym class, your math class. And imagine the psychic jarring that has happened to this generation of kids that like they found out, no matter what anybody says, actually there's always the possibility that it all turns out to be worth nothing, man. My principal could be lying to himself when he says up and down, you're never gonna, if you don't apply yourself in English class, you're never gonna have a future because here's how the world works. And it turns out that motherfucker doesn't know how the world works. There's gonna be an equal number of people who are destroyed by that experience, but there's gonna be so many, there is such a healthy thing to draw from that, because it's not a good thing that you and I, when we were 17, felt the way we did about the importance of our schooling. It was too much. It was too extreme. It was like we're still living with scars of it. It did not fucking matter that we graduated high school. God damn it. We may be exceptions to the rule, but like my high school diploma has not been seen by anybody at DreamWorks. Like no one knows whether I dropped out of high school or not.
No one cares.
And it didn't matter that I went to college or that I dropped out. But anyways, whatever. Just to say that this is a breath for everybody, including parents of those kids. Like, how much grief have you put into your kid's soccer league, their bowling game, their haircut, like whatever parents get on their kids about these days. Obviously, what we're all learning here is that it's possible for none of that to really matter. And it's interesting that you boil it down to, like, when you were talking about that, I was like, oh, fuck, when's the last time in between inhale and exhale I actually stopped and made a decision to exhale and remembered that it's my decision? I mean, it's kind of not my decision, but it's – I can
– You can make it yours.
Yeah, you can, like, stop and, like, change timelines entirely by exhaling at a different time than you were gonna.
Holy shit, Dan. I love you, man. I cannot wait to see you in the flesh again. Thank you so much for giving me time during the pandemic. It's always mind-blowing to talk to you. Thank you for this.
I miss you so much, buddy. I'm actually, we were seeing each other less before the pandemic, so I'm still good with the pandemic, because if we wait for our schedules to make it work, it doesn't work. But I've really been looking forward to seeing you again and talking to you, and I appreciate you reaching out.
Thank you, Dan. Tell Cody I, and maybe not you, you're immunocompromised, but maybe you could get her to go unplug your Tesla. Let's keep
You think I'm gonna, oh man, what if I got Corona from the handle of my
Don't
Tesla?
Go out there. Give it a couple of weeks. Thank you, Dan. I appreciate
All right, buddy.
It. See you.
Thanks so much for listening, everybody. That was Dan Harmon. All of what you need to find Dan would be at DuncanKessel.com. Make sure you check out our data link and data feed. The DTFH is this episode of Midnight Gospel.
Midnight Gospel.
And don't forget,
in the Netflix.
Announcement from Venen Industries. Prepare to receive sounding from chromatic ribbons.